propagating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to The John Age Project.
Thank you for joining us again on the Anomic Age. I'm your host, John Age. It's April 11th, 2019, and we are well into episode number 17. So, all kinds of good stuff to talk about today. I say that, I don't think I'm really being truthful. There's a lot of bad stuff to talk about today. It'd be funny if the show was like this uplifting, happy, fun things to talk about show. But unfortunately, I call it the Anomic Age for a reason. I covered that a few times. You know, I call it the Anomic Age because Bizarro World, Satanic Death Cult didn't really roll off the tongue too well. It's a little bit too long of a URL, and I don't have the rights to Bizarro World. But to be honest, between you, me, and the listening public, I've been very cynical and dark lately. It's not good. I'm trying to do better. Even for me, I've been more cynical and dark than I typically am. So I apologize to anyone who I've unintentionally been not so nice to. I'm sorry. I'm going to do better, I promise. But yeah, but the behind-the-scenes version of this show is insane. There would be a whole new audience if it was a behind-the-scenes version. The last few months, the entirety of 2019 has not really been that good. The show's been great. You guys have been lovely. But, yeah, a lot of stuff going on in the real world, so to speak. Ended up hurting my knee a couple weekends ago, and that really put a damper on things. It was last weekend, for Pete's sakes. So, yeah. Perhaps skateboarding after 40 is not always the best idea. You can't always pull the same tricks you could do, you know, in your mid-teens. Nonetheless, since I have no health insurance, I'm very hopeful that it's just a sprain and not a tear, I hope. Wow, a lot of stuff. Today will be the last time we are recording in this location. When we speak next time, we'll be in a whole new locale. So I don't know if that's going to be for better or for worse, but it will be, I suppose, nonetheless. This will be the last final recording in this location. So there's that. That's always scary. The prospect of something new. But seriously, back to the darkness and the cynicism. I feel like our reality nowadays, it warrants that. I don't know how. I meet positive people from time to time, and they scare me. I sort of want to shake them and say, have you looked around lately? Gone to the store and interacted with the public? This is weird out there, man. Yeah, if you actually read any of the news or follow any of that stuff, it's even more bizarre. So, I'm working on it. Cynicism's going to get brought down. I'm going to do better. We have a plethora of news, as usual. I don't know where to begin first. I mean, just reading the short amount of news that we're going to cover in this program, it warrants itself to a healthy dose of sarcasm, if not cynicism. This is coming from Breitbart. Who's the author of this lovely piece? Dr. Susan Berry. Atlanta mayor welcomes drag queen story hour to City Hall after library pulls the plug. I don't have a picture of the Atlanta mayor, but I have a pretty good visual in my mind's eye as to what the usual ilk of the communist variety look like, and it's always quite. If you're following along with this Breitbart article, the thing they're showing you here is pretty scary also. I don't even know why I'm surprised. Let me read a little bit of it. I'll save you the whole spiel. Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, tweeted an invitation Friday to allow a drag queen story hour at City Hall after the Atlanta Fulton Public Library System removed one of the story hours from its calendar. Yep, there you go. Keisha Lance Bottoms. I'm pulling a lot back right now. I'm very tempted to go full me uncensored, but I'd like to sort of keep it at a G rating, so I'll stop. Here we go. Miss Terracotta Sugar Baker and all of our LGBTQ friends are always welcome at Atlanta City Hall, posted Bottoms. Insert your joke here, folks. I don't know if I can read much more of this without going into full sarcasm. How about we host your next story hour at City of Atlanta? Let's make it happen. So, in my opinion, this buffoon is just pandering to more votes, albeit the lowest common denominator of votes. But then again, if you take a look at the mayor, it's probably not surprising. Yeah, it just continues. I'll just stop now before I get any darker, because why? Why would I do that? You just see this again and again and again. If you follow the news at all, this is just ubiquitous. It's all across America now. We're having drag queens coming in and talking to the kids and telling stories. And if you followed some of this other news, I don't even have this article pulled up, but it was in Texas where no less than two, perhaps three, of these lovely citizens were also convicted sex offenders. So you've got these mentally ill people, I'm repressing a lot, in dress-up, pretending to be someone else, sex offenders, at least several of those in Texas being the case, and these are the folks that are allowed to tell stories to your children in the local library. The library in Atlanta, at least one of them actually had a little bit of testicular fortitude and pulled the plug, and glory be, the mayor said, come on down to City Hall. Sounds great. Lovely. Let's move on. No, let's not move on. Here I go again. At some point, the people have got to stand up, right? I keep thinking this. And I think that's why I get so agitated lately, because I don't see it occurring. And let me preface any further talk on this by saying, I don't want violence. I'm not calling for any violence at all. I'm just talking about a little spine, a little backbone, a little bit of, nah, this isn't cool. We're not going to have this at our library. Take it somewhere else. Take it to City Hall, I guess, if you're in Atlanta and you want to go down there and hang out with those people in City Hall. But get out of the public library, thanks. Move on. Call me whatever. But where's the people? Outraged. I saw a little bit of this, of course, in Texas. They seem to be the last vestige of anything resembling a brain and a spine, guts, what have you. The rest of the republic seems to be on leave. I don't know. I just that's really what gets me so riled up lately. Just the complete ineptitude, inactivity, laziness. I don't know what you want to call it. Pathetic, weak nature of the American people. No violence, just a little bit of action. Just a little, nope, we're good. You know, a few thousand people, a few million people standing up to this sort of bizarre garbage in every city that they're trying to foist it upon you would probably cause all this to cease. Let them play all the communist semantical games they want. But at some point, the people have to stop being afraid of what they're being called and actually stand up for what's right. Again, I don't know why people care about what they're being called anyway. As my mother and grandmother used to say, consider the source when someone says something disparaging about you. Consider the source. Yeah, the code for that is really saying, hey, the person saying it is usually a pile of refuse, so don't take it so bad. Let's move on into article number 2. Thousands of people in Sweden are embedding microchips under their skin to replace ID cards. Ooh, that sounds nice. This is from businessinsider.com. Who we got here? Alexandra Ma is the writer of this piece from May 14, 2018. This is an old piece. But it, you know, I've given you guys a little bit of old news lately for a good reason. I'm not just doing it by accident. I'm doing it because this is old news and people are still not getting it. About 3,000 Swedish people have inserted a microchip into their bodies to make their daily lives easier. People with implants can wave their hands near a machine to unlock their office or gym rather than taking out a key card. Whew, well, that's worth it. So-called biohacking is on the rise as more people depend on wearable technology and interconnected devices. It just goes on and on. I mean, yeah, this is a 2018 article, and as I said, for good reason. I want people, I'm sort of peppering our news with a little bit of old news lately, just so people get it. If it was 3,000 in 2018, how many do you think have this now in Sweden? And I have to ask, what the heck is going on in Sweden? I've covered this before, but I never really had any ill-conceived notions of Sweden until the last few years. You know, they've abandoned all culture of the Swedish people in exchange for an invasion of third world scum. I just don't get it, man. I mean, they're turning Muslim. They're allowing their people to be raped, murdered, pillaged, beaten, and so forth. And this one, they're pushing their the microchip agenda. I don't even think they're pushing it. They got 3,000 people just doing it. I don't know. Maybe they missed that that bit in Revelations about taking a chip. I don't know. If for no other reason, if I saw that in Revelation and someone offered it to me, I'd say, I'm good, thanks. The rest of Revelation doesn't look so promising. The chip? Oh, I can open my car and door now? That's a good thing, I guess. Okay. This one's coming from dailymail.co.uk. And I almost conflated. These are two separate stories. I'll read you the first one, then we'll get into the second one. My brain, I conflated the two. I didn't even realize that these were separate incidences because I don't care about Hollywood. I think all those people are what they appear to be. Insert your expletive here. They're nothing but pushing propaganda of the communists to try to indoctrinate what's left of the American people with a brain into their idiotic, subhuman way of life. That's what I see Hollywood as being. It hasn't changed all that much. If you read the book, and I always say this, it's called propaganda. His name was Edward Bernays. I believe he was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. But yeah, Bernays quite literally wrote the book Propaganda. No jest. It's real. That's it. It's called propaganda. You know, he went on in the early 1900s to receive monies from several huge corporations to, first and foremost, to get women to smoke. Not enough women were smoking. So he pulled this whole torches of freedom charade and was sort of piggybacking on the first wave of feminism. And the American people were so stupid. They're like, oh, yeah, it's torches of freedom. Sounds very reminiscent of Bush's freedom fries about 20 years ago. Equally idiotic. But in this case, he was pushing the narrative that women need to smoke, and it's their rights, and oh, they're going to get out from under this oppressive patriarchy and show those men type they can smoke too. Oh boy, you too can get lung cancer and contaminate everyone around you with your poisonous garbage. But that was Edward Bernays. He also got bacon and eggs as a staple at the breakfast table. Believe it or not, it wasn't a norm until old Edward was paid by the hog industry to push that little ditty. But one of the other things he was doing was he was infusing What was in that stage, very early Hollywood. Hollywood was really in its infancy, so people weren't as stupid as they are now, where they just believe these paid talking head liars that they're actually legitimate. But this was in its infancy, you know. Early Hollywood, early television was really starting to roll out about 10 years later. But he was one of the first folks to really get, I guess, people to buy into Hollywood as being something that they should aspire to, or that these people were somehow some sort of half-hearted U.S. royalty that we should just listen to and aspire to be like, these great Hollywood elites. So he was one of the first ones to get a lot of actors and actresses to be spokesmen for different products. And in my opinion, you're seeing that today. I mean, in this article, they're not coming out and saying that, but that's definitely the inclination here. I've danced all around this and not talked about it, so let's get into it. DailyMail.co.uk by Emma Shepherd for Daily Mail Australia. Naomi Watts looks windswept as she walks her son Samuel Kai, 10, home from school in New York City. See, here we go again, where most of the news isn't really news. It's idiotic, stupid garbage. I took my daughter to school this morning. I didn't make the front page anywhere. Why would I? It's idiotic. Anyway, Samuel Kai. Here we go again with the stupid names. My wife and I have discussed this ad nauseum, because I feel like our daughter is going to be one of the few people in her generation to not be named something retarded. Idiotic, stupid, foolish, dumb. Samuel Kai. Great. Samuel, not so bad. I don't know what the Kai is coming from. And this is quite a tame name, considering most of the people in this generation are completely named after something even more idiotic. The weather is warm in New York City, but winter is coming for Naomi Watts as she prepares to film the Game of Thrones prequel in the coming months. And ahead of the highly anticipated fantasy show, more stupid dribble. I can't stand any of these shows. It's all CGI love fests or these bow and arrow movies. But I digress. The Mulholland Drive star, 50, enjoyed some quality family time on Monday afternoon. Naomi was pictured strolling through the streets of Tribeca with her youngest son, Samuel. Yeah. You're not picking up on this because you can't see this. But if you were seeing young Samuel here, I'm trying to be nice. This is a child. The onus is not on him. It's on the parents. I'll just leave it at this. Look up the article for yourself. Samuel does not look like Samuel at all. Perhaps Samantha, Sarah, but not Samuel. I'll leave it at that. In short, she has her boy dressed like a girl and is wandering about New York City. Nice move, Naomi Watts. Let's move on. Can't stomach much more. Oh, what else we got? Here's the other article. Where is the other article? Oh, man, I know I had two of these jokers. Didn't I? Well, perhaps not. Anyway, nonetheless, let's move on. See if we can find this really quickly. Here we go, here we go, here we go. I knew it was there. It was hiding from me. This little ditty. Oh, Charlize Theron, adopted son. This isn't the actual article, it's just a post about it. She has dressed him as a girl since shortly after she adopted him. At 5, it was announced he was transitioning. At 7, it was announced he was a girl. Oh, goody. Charlize Theron. So she adopted this little African boy, I'm assuming, or maybe African-American boy, I don't know. Nonetheless, at 5, it was announced he was transitioning. So clearly a 5-year-old child doesn't know transitioning from Transformers, but I'm sure old Charlize took it upon herself to get all kinds of fun publicity just like Naomi Watts and push some more transformative agendas on the idiotic American people that are dumb enough to buy it. So there's that. Last but certainly not least, this is the one that was really getting on my nerves here. This is coming from michaelsavage.com. Mayor de Blasio declares public health emergency, orders mandatory vaccinations. Oh boy. If you stayed tuned to this week's episode and you listened to last week's episode as well, I covered this in last week's episode a little bit, but the can hadn't been kicked down the road that much. Last week, it was just a curfew for those children that were unvaccinated. Now they're taking it one step beyond. And old de Blasio, I'll read it to you. The de Blasio administration declared a public health emergency in a selected zip code in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, following a measles outbreak affecting the Orthodox Jewish community. Okay, so we got a lot of variables here. So we're clearly targeting one community with this draconian tyranny. So last week it was just a curfew of children, if you hadn't been vaccinated, of course. I don't know how they were checking these children's papers or something. I mean, if you're a kid, you don't even have an ID. Not yet. I'm sure soon you'll have a chip and an ID, and they'll be checking you on the street with some of this stop-and-frisk horse pucky to make sure you've been vaccinated. And if not, I guess they'll drag you off to a torture chamber or some sort of post-birth abortion, perhaps. I don't know. But in this instance, de Blasio is declaring a public health emergency and ordering mandatory vaccines. Pathetic. That's pathetic. And I've said before, I think all this is nothing more than an acclimatization. He's acclimating the public here. That's what they're doing. I think we covered this last week as well. I think it was Arizona where a couple had their children taken because they didn't vaccinate. It was another, raid the house, steal the kids sort of thing. It's no big deal. So they did it there, and the pathetic public did nothing. Last week, they did the curfew. The pathetic public did nothing. And this week, they're doing mandatory vaccinations, and the pathetic public has done, say it with me, folks, nothing. Nadie. Nada. Por supuesto, no? Nadie. So, again, this is all just a way to acclimate the public. It's an acclimatization scam. That's all this is. They're making sure that the public is pathetic enough to go, oh, that's okay. It's somebody else's problem. Oh, it's just the guy down the street. Oh, it's just a person over here. And pretty soon it'll be, where's your papers? Where's your effects? We're here to search and make sure, you've been vaccinated. Is that your kids? You've been vaccinated? Get in the truck. That's how it's going to be. And apparently the people will do nothing. So, I don't even know what to say at some point. I've become so disheartened with it all just because of the lack of anything. I mean, here and there, perhaps you're seeing more of it and it's just not making the mainstream news and it's not making the alternative news, quote unquote, whatever the heck that is. But, I'm not seeing these million people marches of people marching against the medical tyranny. I'm not seeing it against the kidnapping of the children or anything else. And all this is predicated on the usual suspects. It's all predicated on the safety of the public. When all else fails, pull the safety card. It's for your safety. It's for your safety. Hey, I have a question. What about the millions of illegals that you're letting into the border that haven't been vaccinated at all? What about them? They're all coming from third world slums, not just in Central America and Mexico, but also from the third world in the central, the Fertile Crescent. Yes, the Crescent. The Crescent of Islam. And North Africa and all that. What about all those folks that are coming in? Also, we don't have any clue what they got because you're not checking anything. You're just going, come on in. Or better yet, they step a toe into the U.S. border and instead of pointing an M4 at them and saying, get to stepping or you toast, once they step a toe onto the U.S. border, then you have to take them in and process them and deal with the kids and deal with the parents and deal with everybody else and give them some food and some health care and everything else that the common American person probably doesn't even have either. So while you're doing all that, there's these quote-unquote health crises emerging. Measles. Oh. I've never had the measles, but I guarantee it's not a health crisis. Both my parents had the measles. Most of the other members of my family in the previous generation had the measles, and they're still here. It's not a health crisis anymore. The chickenpox is a health crisis. It's the measles. A health crisis would be like the bubonic plague or Ebola. The common cold, the measles, the mumps, chickenpox, not a health crisis. It wasn't a health crisis in the 50s and 60s, and it sure as heck isn't a health crisis in 2019, when supposedly the medical mafia has tons more advances to treat these crises. Woo-hoo-hoo. Spooky. Either way, I'll try to get off my soapbox and try to come down to earth and be a little bit more genteel. We have to, because we have an excellent, excellent two guests today. I was going to say guest, but guests, plural. We have Mrs. Anna Lawrence, and we also have her attorney, John Mayer, and they will both be discussing Anna's son, Clint Lawrence, who went through quite an ordeal, which we will get into on the other side of this also brief break. So please stay tuned for all that and then some in a mere matter of seconds. Please, as always, share the links, AnomicAge.com. Share that with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. Please share the links. I'm the world's worst for not supporting myself, for not telling people to share the links, for not telling people to like the videos, for not telling people to share the videos. I can't even post anything else on Brighteon right now because I need 100 more views just so I can post up into the next tier. I love Brighteon. I love what those folks are doing. But I get it. It's purely a monetary thing. I mean, they perhaps don't have the Fed money and the backing that YouTube does, so they can't just go carte blanche, sure, post a million videos if you want. We'll got you covered on the bandwidth. I understand. But I would much rather support you guys than YouTube. So hit me up. Give me 100 more views over there, and I'll post a whole lot more videos. It'll put me up into the next tier. Or you can give me a whole lot more likes, and I'll just move on up into tiers. I won't even have to have this conversation again. So if you'll notice, I haven't posted on Brighteon in about 4 episodes, and that's why. And thanks to myself, I forget to tell people to view that and to like it and to do all the stuff you're supposed to do. So please, view Brighteon first. If you haven't been caught up on all the old episodes and all the old programs, please do that. Check it out. Hit the like button. Share the links. Do it a couple times if you need to. That's just fine with me. But likewise on YouTube, which I completely and utterly detest. But I have no alternative. I can't afford my own awesome server with unlimited bandwidth, so I'm using theirs right now to post my videos as well. And surprisingly, nothing's been taken down or really hit all that much yet. I got a few complaints that I'm going to handle with them whenever I have the time. I don't know when that'll be, but all that being said, please check out AnomicAge.com for everything from this week's guests and shows to previous. Check out the apps if you have the Android or the iPhone. You could do either of them or both. As always, you can sign up for the newsletter in the bottom right, and perhaps most importantly, for all things keeping this show, program, and all the ridiculous websites problems, which I've had several lately, a float. Donate at the bottom there. I know it's PayPal. I'm working on that too. Trying to get out of that mess as well. But the best way to get out of that mess is to have a lot of funds to to pay my way out of all these messes into my own server space and into all the lovely protection and such that I've had to purchase lately for the site. So, AnomicAge.com. Check it out. Share it with your friends, talk it up, like the links and all that jazz. Now that I've finally plugged myself and my own show, we can get into our very interesting guests Very riveting story. Please check it out. Share it. We'll be speaking with John Mayer and Mrs. Anna Lawrence in just a matter of seconds. See you in a bit. Okay, we are pleased to welcome onto the program today attorney John Mayer and Mrs. Lawrence. We're going to cover a really interesting case. It's the best way to put it today. The short intro here: in July 2012, while serving as a rifle platoon leader in a remote sector of the Kandahar province of Afghanistan, First Lieutenant Clint Lawrence, platoon, embarked on what was seemingly a normal combat patrol. Clint's patrol, consisting of 16 U.S. infantrymen, 5 Afghan National Army soldiers, and 1 U.S. interpreter, left their strong point early in the morning on July 2, 2012, to a neighboring village. The platoon knew this village all too well, as only days prior, one of their brothers, a U.S. soldier, had been shot in the neck in this very village. So we're joined with our two guests, Anna Lawrence. This is Clint's mother and their attorney, as aforementioned, John Mayer. And we are very pleased to have them on the show today just to really get into this whole situation and hopefully bring a whole lot more light into an incident that I don't think a lot of people know, or at least not enough people know about this incident. So I want to thank both of you for taking the time and joining on the program.
Thank you, John, for having us on.
Oh, absolutely welcome. This is a tough case. I was really thinking about this. I always try to sort of mentally prepare these things before we actually have the program. And it's always really tough for me when I speak with a parent, which I've done a few times, who has an incident involving a child or involving a loved one, because as a father myself, I always immediately sort of put myself in those scenarios and really try to be, I guess, prudent in the way we approach this. So how do you want to approach it as best, Anna or John, either one?
Well, I would like to say, as Clint's mother, it has been 6 years that my son's been sitting in prison, and it has been the most trying time of our life. The new book that Don Brown just came out with, Travesty of Justice, is the shocking prosecution of Lieutenant Clint Lawrence. And I have just completed this book, and as Clint's mother, I had tears streaming while I was walking through that battlefield in this book. And there is no reason at all that my son is sitting in prison. The guys that was killed that day were enemy combatants, and that evidence was withheld from the court-martial. We have since learned so much evidence after the court-martial, because we got John Maher on our case, and he's a fighter, and he's dug deep and found that this story is just totally, totally unacceptable that my son has spent one day in prison. They were not innocent civilians, and that was not a safe zone that he was in, like the court-martial prosecutors tried to get the jury to believe. He was in a war zone. He wasn't on the street in New York. My son never shot his weapon, but he ordered after he was told of the threat. And that's his job. He went there with two things on his mind: to do his job that he was asked to do and trained to do, and to bring all of his men home. And he brought all of his men home safe. Mm-hmm. And it's, John has a lot that he could share with you that is the evidence that we've since found out after the court martial.
Sure.
Yeah, and I'm happy to do that, Anna. And John, thank you, sir, for having us on. Like Anna said, Don Brown is a former Navy judge advocate and civilian attorney, and this is his 14th book, and we think that it's having just come out will hopefully, much like yourself, lend a voice of awareness and continue a national conversation as to the shocking truth of really what happened in the Lawrence case. And those shocking things, as a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve myself and former prosecutor in the 1st Infantry Division as well as Defense Appellate Counsel, is the idea that prosecutors had at their fingertips biometric information to establish the identities and affiliations of every Afghan on the field that day, and either they didn't do it or they suppressed it. Either way, that's a Fifth Amendment due process challenge. In other words, one of the theories of the prosecution was that the people that were killed that day were innocent civilians, otherwise known as CIVCAS. But biometric information in the form of fingerprints and skin, meaning DNA, that they left on bombs on IEDs at grid coordinates where American personnel had been killed or injured, mm-hmm. proved conclusively to the standard of trustworthiness of fingerprints and DNA that they weren't innocent civilians. And neither Clint, the jury, nor Clint's trial lawyers had the opportunity to use that evidence to develop it and to present a compelling case to the jury that this man was doing his duty, that his instincts to fire that day were correct. And here's the other link, if you will, to the belt buckle, and that is Lieutenant Lawrence relied on the hasty rules of engagement assessment of one of his experienced paratroopers who fired his rifle but missed. Lawrence, his duty was to protect the platoon and to bring them home. He relied on that order to give an order to a gun truck, which is an armored vehicle with a M240 Bravo machine gun mounted on its turret, to fire. And testimony at the court-martial revealed that those rounds went off and struck the three riders on the motorcycle, three military-age males on a single motorcycle, within 2 to 5 to 7 to 10 seconds. So the idea here, legally speaking, which I think lends itself to supporting the shocking part of the court-martial, is that an infantry platoon leader in his second day on the job relies on an infantryman's assessment of a threat of three military-age males approaching on a motorcycle, knowing that motorcycles can become what's called V-beds, vehicle-borne IEDs, fires his rifle. The lieutenant gives the order to fire to a gun truck he positioned purposefully in the very position it was in order to protect the platoon, and you killed the right guys. That cannot be murder. Instead, that's what we ask American paratroopers to do in Kandahar province in Afghanistan in 2012. And the flip side is, had Lawrence not given the order, and that motorcycle continued on and blew itself up and killed or wounded paratroopers, he probably would have been judged anyway for dereliction of duty. And if you want to juxtapose or draw a contrast, in December 2015, a year and a half or so after what happened with Lawrence in his platoon, six Bagram airmen were conducting a dismounted patrol just outside Bagram, Air Force National Guardsmen who had been activated to active duty or mobilized to active duty, and a single motorcycle rode up and exploded and killed all of them. And I'm sure that those people in hindsight would have wanted to fire and face a court-martial rather than be a casualty killed in action. So that's one of the main parts of the shocking part of this case. And then there's another part, too, if I may, and that is one of the theories of the prosecution, like I said, was that Lawrence was ordered fire on civilians, CIVCAS. Well, the Army had a significant activity report, and that significant activity report is dated 1 month after the July 2nd, 2012 engagement. And I'm nearly quoting from memory here, and it says that Lawrence's platoon was being scouted for an impending ambush or attack, and that at least one enemy KIA insurgent was confirmed killed. That was never disclosed to the defense, and that is a constitutional problem. In other words, the United States Constitution wasn't at Clint Lawrence's trial. And that's why I think Don Brown is very accurate when he says this is a shocking case.
Wow.
Don Brown being the author of Travesty of Justice, which is available on Amazon.com right now and is also being supported by United American Patriots, a nonprofit organization that provides resources to protect and defend military members largely accused of crime in combat.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that was a lot, and I'm terribly sorry if I said too much, but there's some more details too. But in working with Clint Lawrence and in working with the Lawrence family and with the team of attorneys, all of whom are former active duty prosecutors, I think we've been very fortunate to uncover this evidence. And right now, we have filed a lawsuit in Kansas, in the United States District Court and Civilian Court, asking a federal judge to determine if the United States Constitution was at Lawrence's trial. And we've, of course, suggested the answer that it was not. At the same time, we're also hoping that President Trump will disapprove the findings in the sentence for Clint Lawrence. And as the commander-in-chief, he has that authority to do so. And we've been trying to get our message to the president through the Secretary of the Army and through the Office of the Pardon Attorney, but thus far we have not been successful. And we do think that this could be something that the president could do based upon his having run on a campaign of correcting the failed policies of the previous administration. In relatively short order, he can take action here to correct a terrible injustice and send a message to our military service members as well as law enforcement that we have your back and we're not going to second guess or Monday morning quarterback your combat decisions.
So if I'm gathering everything correctly, let me sort of see if I can surmise here. Clint was on patrol. He was going to a neighboring village. They already had some sort of intel that there were possible combatants in this area. That was pretty well established, correct?
That's correct. They had lost four paratroopers immediately before Lawrence took command, one of whom was the previous platoon leader who had been blown up with peppering shrapnel wounds to the face, eyes, and abdomen on the very same patrol route that Lawrence was now leading the platoon. So yes, that is correct.
And the men see a motorcycle approaching with three males on it, military-age males, and these are well established that they're often basically mobile IEDs that are just going to ram into and explode whatever they happen to do.
The soldier who fired his rifle but missed, mm-hmm. he testified initially he testified that he not only did he perceive it as a threat, and he was entitled to protect himself and a platoon, but he also elaborated by saying he thought it could be not only a VBED, a vehicle-borne IED, but also it could be a drive-by, it could be a shooting, it could be a grenade toss, and those are largely his words, taken from his observations at the time. And there's more, too. Another issue that we've raised and we've asked the federal court to look at, and we've also asked the president to look at, which is showcased in Don Brown's book, Travesty of Justice, is the idea that senior Army uniformed officers of the JAG Corps have continued to publicly misinform the American public and at least one member of the Congress that Lawrence was convicted of an offense for which he was found not guilty. In other words, the chief judge of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals in uniform appeared in a recorded panel discussion about the My Lai massacre and likened Lieutenant Lawrence to Lieutenant Kelly, who actually fired his rifle into civilians and noncombatants and authorized his platoon to do so on a widely inapplicable analogy by calling Lawrence a bad apple who came off the rails. And the problem with that is the chief judge articulated that Lawrence changed the rules of engagement to authorize fire on any motorcycle indiscriminately. The problem legally, though, is the jury found him not guilty of that offense, but yet the chief judge decided to espouse that and point that out incorrectly, we think, to spoil the well against supporting Lawrence and to defend the Army from this shocking prosecution. And that was an opportunity to exercise moral courage and take corrective action that was missed. And so we, as the appellate defense team, wrote him a letter and asked him to take corrective action, pointing out the inaccuracies. And he initially granted us a meeting, but it became obvious to us that we were being slow-walked that died in the vine. But the really problematic issue is the Judge Advocate General of the Army, Lieutenant General Charles Petey, who's the senior most uniformed legal officer in the Army legal system. He, months after General Berger's misinformation, repeated largely the same thing to Congressman Garrett Graves from Louisiana during a telephone call. And that, to me, is an abdication of a legal officer's responsibility for accuracy. And candidly, that is also a misinformation that is hurting our client because people are going to believe the Army.
Of course.
And they're going to say, well, the jury spoke, the appellate court spoke. But the real issue, too, is an important one. At that level, we would hope that those senior leaders are more concerned with the reliability of the process of military justice and producing a reliable and trustworthy result, rather than defending the Army as an advocate. And that's largely what they're doing here. They're defending the result of this case rather than the process by which the erroneous and incorrect result was achieved and produced. So that, too, is portrayed in painstaking detail in Mr. Brown's book. And Mr. Brown goes to source authorities. He goes to the trial transcripts. He goes to the appellate briefings. And everything in the book is public information. And, of course, he's done a fine job. Like Anna said a moment ago, Clint's mother, there were many things that Mr. Brown portrays in terms of the actual combat patrol that we really haven't come to light because we've been fighting a legal battle rather than telling the real story of the dangerous combat in Afghanistan in 2012. And Anna, just the other day in a call with me, said there's things about her son she never knew. And so it was a compelling, gripping story, not only about the shocking trial and court-martial, but also about the kinetic combat in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, this could really be myopic on my part, and I think you could probably speak to this more than myself, but this doesn't seem like an odd occurrence in this part of the world, especially during that time frame where you would have a possible enemy combatants in a motorcycle and another vehicle coming at you. You say, stop, halt, and they don't, and they get fired upon. I mean, that seems to not be the most odd of occurrences. So why in the world are they targeting your client so heavily?
You would think. I think that's a very fine point, and it's well taken. I think, extrapolating, if you look to the next district, Lieutenant Lawrence operated in the Kandahar province in the Zare district. In the next district over is Panjaway. And only months prior, in March of 2012, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales shot and killed 16 civilians at night. So looking at the cause and effect or the temporal and timing connection of it, it seems that the Army's reaction to portray Lawrence as off the reservation, a bad apple who came off the rails, and show that he was a madman, quote-unquote, would not only separate the Army chain of command from any negative consequence to their own career trajectories, but also that the United States was taking corrective action when the report of CIVCAS went up. I think that's probably what happened.
So it sounds like they're trying to make an example out of him over what happened with another person.
And Mr. Brown, Don Brown, says it in his book, Travesty of Justice, that it's the sacrifice of Lieutenant Lawrence at the altar of political correctness, I believe is one of his sentences.
That sounds exactly like what's going on. Because, I mean, I take it that there was no prior history. You know, you might say if a police officer has been belligerent or attacking people on the street, well, he's got a prior history and then he lost it and so and so. I'm guessing that's not the case with this gentleman at all.
I think that's a fine question, sir. No, it's not. As a matter of fact, Clint was an enlisted soldier for 10 years prior to becoming an officer. He had a beautiful record, unblemished. He had served in Korea, South Korea. He had served in Iraq. He was a military police officer. The Army chose him for a hard slot to get in the Green to Gold program, where officers are commissioned after having been enlisted personnel. And he was relatively new to the officer corps as well as to the infantry. And so he was selected that day by the brigade commander to take over and go into a hotly kinetic gunfight situation where Command Sergeant Major Gustafson, the battalion sergeant major, informed us that every time 1st Platoon went outside the wire, they were taking rounds and sending rounds. In other words, they were fired upon and returning fire. So Lawrence was picked out 48 to 72 hours ahead of time to go in and replace the previous platoon leader, and that decision was probably that he was red hot, that he was up for the job, that he was smart and sharp, intelligent, and capable of performing the mission in a very dangerous, unforgiving environment. And then 72 hours later, he's a bad apple off the rails. It just doesn't make sense.
Not at all. Just speaking from a normal human perspective, going into that sort of environment, you would obviously have your ears up and your eyes, you know, obviously in any part of the world in that region, especially if you're going into what you just said is a hot area where they'd already had prior incidences of IED attacks. He's taken the place of a former commanding officer that was shot. I mean, I'm using logic again, so I know logic is an anathema to all things politically correct, but...
If I could share another shocking part about the case, too, for your listenership or your viewership.
Sure, please.
And that is Lieutenant Latino, Dominic Latino. He was the platoon leader who was wounded in action and medically evacuated from the field. Lawrence replaced him. A month later, August 2, 2012, he was recovering from his wounds on Fort Belvoir in Virginia, and he gave a statement to the CID, the Army's detectives. And in his statement, it's about 3 pages, single-spaced, typewritten, but there's only one sentence that's lined out, meaning struck out with a single line in penmanship by handwriting, and that is, he never, as platoon leader, would have let a motorcycle get near his platoon for fear of enemy TTP, techniques, tactics, and procedures where the enemy would blow itself up. And that is the only sentence in the entire statement that's been lined out. And it just so happens that that sentence helps Lawrence and hurts the Army.
Wow.
We uncovered that, too, after trial.
So was that lined out by the officer or by someone else in the Army to obfuscate the evidence?
I think the answer is, is specifically his initials appear after the line out.
Okay, I got
But why, of all things, is he going to change that? So, and Anna, this might be a good point for you to talk about Mr. Womack and the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that we've brought on appeal and now in federal court in Kansas.
Well, Mr. Womack was a very nice guy, but he was way overconfident. And he didn't spend adequate time with Clint. He only seen Clint twice, charged us $40,000. None of our family had ever been to a court martial, never been to court. We had no idea what was going on and what to expect. So we totally trusted our attorney. And he come highly recommended. Well, Clint didn't visit with him, but twice. And once was, the second time he seen him was the morning of Clint's court martial. He called into town the night before and called Clint to update him on the case. The family was all there with Clint, and we were blown away. We were, at that point, was very scared because we felt he should have knew this case front and backwards. My son was going up for murder, you know, and he could get a life sentence. So that made us nervous, and the next day that we went to the court martial, my husband and I asked Womack. He took us into a back room for us to talk to him and for us to meet him. And I asked him, is my son going to go to jail? And he said, absolutely not. He said he may get reprimanded with a little slap on the hand, but he was in a war zone and he will not go to prison. And I said, how sure are you? And he said, 100% sure. My husband and I both stood there and heard him say that. So once again, we was built up. Okay, he knows what he's doing. He's a lawyer. And that wasn't the case. They totally railroaded my son. And to me, it felt like there was a pack of dogs on my five-year-old boy, chewing him alive, because the man that they were talking about was not even my son. We knew that there was a problem. We knew that they'd got it wrong and thought that they would fix it. And now, 6 years later, ever since John Meyer got on our team after the court martial, we're finding out all of this evidence that he was used as a scapegoat to appease the Afghanistan army. This was purposely done to him by his very own, that he chose willingly and proudly to support and would have continued with his career until he retired as an old man. He loved serving his country. And to me, for us to, as the, in the United States, to disrespect any soldier that is strong enough and proud enough to serve their country, to put those boots on every day. When most of us sit on our couch and eat chips and watch TV, they're over there stepping on landmines and scared to step down the next step, afraid that they will that will be their last day. Every time they walk out of that gate, this may be my last day. When most of the people in United States never even know that feeling. I'm Clint's mother. I have no idea what that feels like. Have no idea what it feels like that there's nothing under the streets that I walk on. So I admire anybody that will stand and do that for our country so that I'm free. But for us to take in our government or the high brass and turn this around to throw those brave in jail, then killed, more of them are killed. They're going to come home and go to prison. That is absolutely un-American, because what we're doing is we're showing Afghanistan that we're not in this to win. We look like cowards.
Hey, showing Anna,
our
if I could
country
jump in there.
To look weak. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, Anna. I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were taking a break there. But John, one of the things, too, that happened here that is shocking is 9 paratroopers were taken off the line that day, and 9 of them were accused of murder just like Clint. All of them were given sworn statement forms, and then only after they gave their statements were they informed that they could talk with a lawyer under Article 31 of the UCMJ. Now, those charges stuck around for a while and were hanging over these paratroopers' heads. And that, to me, is injustice, because they had no business being charged for murder. But the problem in this case here, on that point, is that each of those paratroopers was then given immunity in exchange for that immunity for the contrived charge of murder, ordered to testify at the Lawrence trial. So the Army hung that over all of their heads, and then put them through that process to convict Lawrence. And on top of it, trial defense counsel, Mr. Womack, did not interview any of them. He interviewed no American witnesses, and he interviewed no Afghan witnesses who are identified in the record of trial. And he never cross-examined them as to why they were testifying against their lieutenant in front of the jury, because they were there involuntarily pursuant to an order to cooperate in exchange for immunity from murder.
Gosh.
That's some of the contorted, twisted tactics that the U.S. Army engaged in achieving this prosecution, which to this day they refuse to give a straight answer to. And no one need look any further than to the Center for Strategic and International Studies of March of 2018 and listen to General Berger's comments of how the Army has been portraying Lawrence to civilian decision makers, which probably explains why we haven't been able to get our message to the president, because they've been misinforming civilian leadership, elected and appointed in Washington. And that specific information can be seen at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And also, I believe, Anna, it's on freeclintlawrence.com, and it's at uap.org as well.
Yeah.
Man, I hate to say wow again, but wow. I think the average person would be shocked at the total injustice going on. Like you said, they already poisoned the well by bringing up charges that he was exonerated from. They got people in his own platoon and basically blackmailed them into scapegoating Mr. Lawrence. And none of this is getting brought to light. I mean, it is, but I guess it's just so disheartening and shocking that where's the justice in this whole justice system? That seems totally insane.
Yes, and the sad thing is, no matter what John has found, no matter what evidence that we have took them or sent to the Army, they refuse to hear us. They refuse to fix it. And there's a reason for that. It makes me wonder, what else are they scared will come to light? There's a reason why they won't fix this. This is their soldier that gave 10 years of his life, a dedicated soldier. And Glenn's not the only one. There's several of our soldiers that's been done this exact same way. And you know, I would, anybody that's listening, I would advise everybody to get on Amazon and order this book, Travesty of Justice. Well, what I was saying is every American, every person that is listening to this interview today, go on Amazon and order this book by Don Brown, Travesty of Justice, The Shocking Prosecution of Lieutenant Clint Lawrence. It will make your blood boil. But if you have, if there's people out there that have any questions about the story or about what actually happened, this book will explain it all to you. And it will let you see exactly what is happening to our U.S. soldiers.
And that's the travesty of justice.
Yes.
It absolutely is. Is there any repercussions for this previous attorney that seemed to... I mean, I'm not an attorney, so I hate to even go there, but it would seem like you would want to talk to your client as much as possible to get the story from them. You would want to talk to the other platoon members that were in the firefight.
And there's Afghan people, there's local nationals on the field that day that CID talked to, but defense counsel didn't, one of whom is the rider of the motorcycle who escaped and for whom Clint stands convicted of attempting to murder. So an attempted murder victim was never interviewed by defense counsel, never even tried to interview him. Shocking.
Yeah, that's my words.
I don't
words,
mean to
exactly.
besmirch anybody unnecessarily, but that's wrong.
And if anything I'm asking we can't answer here, let me know. But has anyone talked to the other platoon members that were basically being blackmailed with also these charges? I mean, where are they in this whole incident?
Well, I think that one of the things, we reached out many times to talk with the platoon, and I think most of them want to get it behind them.
Gotcha.
And they want to put it past them. But one of the things that I hope that they would realize, maybe if they read Don Brown's book, Travesty of Justice, or listen to this program, that they would realize that they too were manipulated by the Army, by having charges. There was no business charging those paratroopers with murder, taking their rifles and pistols away from them as if they were perps, leaving them defenseless in Afghanistan without their own sidearms, and then establishing them and ostracizing them as alleged murderers and holding that over their head for months. And only then giving them immunity from contrived charges in exchange for immunity to prosecute against their own lieutenant. And then compounded like a perfect storm of errors, Mr. Womack, the original attorney, doesn't even cross-examine them on the fact that they're not there voluntarily, that they were there pursuant to an order to cooperate that they received in exchange for immunity from the contrived charges in the first place. And that's just a house of cards or a balsa wood foundation or constructing a straw man in order to get to Lawrence. And that's guileful, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even fathom why any of these charges would stick when all their witnesses are basically coerced into talking. It doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense.
The jury never knew it. Mm. I bet that every person on that jury, 90% of them, if not 100% of them, was asking, why are these paratroopers testifying against their lieutenant? And candidly, that's one of the first questions I had when I reviewed the case when we first came on. It doesn't make sense because institutionally and intuitively and experientially, that just doesn't happen. You're in combat together. You're brothers. You fight and die for one another in the most unbelievable privations, and you suffer through some of the most terrifying and saddening and frightening experiences. That's a big bond.
It is.
So you would think they wouldn't testify. So I'm glad we found the answer, and the answer was the Army charged him with murder. Then the Army gave him immunity and ordered him to testify. That's why they were there, but the jury never knew that because defense counsel did not examine them on that, and the prosecution, candidly, had no obligation except to turn those orders of immunity over, which they did. But it was defense counsel's duty to present that to the jury through those witnesses, and that he did not do.
So they were facing the same fate as Clint, basically, with the court-martial and a sentencing and everything.
Initially, oh yes. Initially, yes. And the Army got their statements first before advising them of their Miranda rights. just threw sworn statement forms at them in one tent called a GP medium and said, you're all going down for murder. Make your statements. And only after the statements came in did the Army then say, oh, by the way, you don't have to talk to us. You need Article 31B rights. And at that point, the lights went on for some paratroopers who invoked their rights and said, I'm not cooperating. And then their own personal sagas and hells and challenges began because they were then being ostracized, stripped of their rifles and pistols in a combat zone, and being ordered not to have communications with Lieutenant Lawrence, and being singled out as not doing your duty, but instead as an accused murderer, and have that hanging over your head for months. That point alone can ruin a person's life.
Absolutely.
That's a hell on earth.
Yeah, I mean, I want everybody to really get what you're saying here. I mean, these folks were honorably serving U.S. military. They went into a firefight one day. I could be off on the timeline, but basically the next day, you're stripped of your weapons, you're thrown in the brig, and now you're persona non grata on the base amongst your fellow soldiers. I mean, that's just crazy.
And who's doing that? Who's pulling those strings? Who's pulling those strings are the captain, the major, the lieutenant colonel, and the commanding general, the major general. Because they, if they did not make Lawrence off the reservation, they stood to have a consequence to their career trajectories, because a CIVCAS just happened next door in the Bales case, literally next door, the next district, Panjway to Zare, and the United States sent Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta set a plane to get Staff Sergeant Bales, and before reviewing any statements or facts, said, we're going to go after the death penalty.
Jeez.
Well, Lawrence's chain of command was probably reading those tea leaves saying, we got to come up with a narrative here to distance ourselves, so we'll make him a crazy person off the rails who wants to fight the war his own way. And the prosecution went so far to say, now this is the heart of darkness, the ancestral home of the Taliban, and in their opening statement, the prosecutor said words to the effect of, Lawrence wanted to manufacture combat. Now, that's what they were ascribing to be his motive. Okay. I don't think you'd had to manufacture combat because you step 20 meters outside the wire. Here it comes. You have to walk in a single file route of march behind a minesweeper. You can't go left or right because you're going to step on a mine, and those mines are changed every night. The locals know where the mines are. They don't need a minesweeper to ride their motorcycles. They know where they are.
But 40 minutes before, Clint went out on that mission, 40 minutes before, am I correct, John? They already knew from the command center, they already knew that Clint was going to get ambushed, correct?
Right, that's right. There's an arrow. Thank you, Anna, for bringing that up. An aerostat is basically another word for a blimp. And okay. I'm sorry if I'm going over things you already know.
No, please.
And the aerostat operators are the eye in the sky. And they're up there with powerful camera equipment for the purpose of conducting scouting operations, because paratroopers can't see over 6 to 8 foot berms that are undulating, that you have to walk in a single file route of march in order to conduct your foot patrol. Well, 30 to 40 minutes prior, the aerostat operator radioed the tactical operations center, listen, saying, you better get a report to 1st Platoon. They're being scouted for an impending attack or ambush. I've got 3 confirmed military-age males in the low crawl position scouting their platoon with AK-47s. And one thing we haven't mentioned, too, the 2 of the battlefield pickups that day, after the 2 gunfights, there was 2 gunfights. The first gunfight was the motorcycle engagement, which killed 2 and a third escaped. His name was Haji Karamula. And then 1st Platoon continued its route of march and got into a second gunfight, killed 2 more in the field, and shot a guy by the name of Muhammad Rahim in the arm. Muhammad Rahim tested positive for HME on his hands, homemade explosive residue. Then, from the westernmost part of the village, a single motorcycle rider is detained by a second gun truck. He, too, tests positive for HME on his hands. So Haji Karamula, the rider from the motorcycle who escaped, and Muhammad Rahim, who was shot by gunfire in the second engagement, both left their fingerprints and DNA on bombs, and both of them admitted to knowing one another. So that shows that this was a coordinated impending attack or ambush. And who knows what could have happened?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to touch on
the final piece too, if I may.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you for letting me bring that up, Anna. And there's just so many things to talk about in this case. And Mr. Brown does a heck of a job laying it all out in a very easy to read, entertaining, gripping read. But with that said, after all of this is said and done, a Tazkira, which is an Afghan national identification card, is left on one of the deceased.
Okay.
Well, the Army gave it back. Never ran the names. Well, all right. So anyway, it is a shocking case, and we thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon about it.
That's it. I'm glad you got into the DNA evidence, or the forensic evidence, rather, because I really wanted you to touch on mm-hmm. that. So, I mean, not only do we have, you know, witness evidence, we got DNA evidence. We got the, in my opinion, coerced testimony of his platoon members. I mean...
The significant activity report that wasn't disclosed, the aerostat operator's warnings, and you know what? There's also a report that defense counsel didn't pursue that the ANA fired first on, the Afghan National Army fired first on the motorcycle riders. Well, there's no forensic to say what bullets got those guys. So by law, if Afghan National Army rounds killed the decedents, then Lawrence's order resulted in a nullity. And that was never investigated by defense counsel. And it should have been developed. You follow the evidence to its natural end.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing they're using different rounds if you're in the Afghan Nationals versus the U.S. military. Am I wrong?
That's a potential, but they're probably using AK-47s and, of course, we're using M4s or M16A2s or 9mm or M240 Bravos.
Gotcha.
But with that said, the analysis was never conducted. And even the CID report says we have no bodies, no rounds to test.
This is just insane.
Because I feel the reason for that is they knew what they were doing beforehand, and they didn't want that because that would make their case harder to solve. I think that it was set up before Clint ever left there. I think it was set up, and nobody will make me think any different. Why else would they hide and cover up all of the evidence that they have and not fix it? They're fighting hard.
Speaking of evidence, Anna just reminded me of another important part of the case.
Sure.
And that is, on appeal, we've only had one appellate decision here.
Okay.
The Army Court of Criminal Appeals heard the case. We moved for a new trial based on this newly discovered evidence. We moved to expedite it because we thought it was that exonerating in order to do justice. And they granted our motion to expedite. But then we had to wait 18 months because then they then ordered us to file an overall appeal. In any event, we asked for oral argument. They wouldn't let us come in and talk to them. Then the judge who wrote the opinion, it was the very last opinion he ever wrote, and he retired. That was the last official act he performed. And apparently, we have this on pretty good information, he had never deployed to a combat zone. So he was probably not familiar firsthand directly with just how ubiquitous and commonplace the use of biometric evidence is to map the local population so we can pick out and discern who the good local nationals are and who the terrorists are. So he wrote that a prosecutor doesn't have an obligation to run something as a simple Google search with an intelligence officer assisting to search into, quote unquote, the abyss of the American intelligence community. And that's just a fundamental misunderstanding. On the one hand, at best, it's a judge not keeping pace with the technology and how we fight the wars today. And at worst, it is an abdication of the office of being a jurist to evaluate the evidence because we submitted as part of our appeal the Commander's Guide to Biometrics in Afghanistan, which is put out by Fort Leavenworth at the Army Center for Excellence. And so it's the Army's own publication, and any court could take judicial notice of something like that. And this court mocked our evidence by calling it an abyss. And it's not an abyss. The United States government has been using this now since 2008. General Petraeus lauds it, ordered it from Iraq into Afghanistan. And he wrote, the New York Times quoted General Petraeus saying, it's infallible in determining because it's DNA. I know there's only one kind. It's
exactly.
Yours or it's not. And then fingerprints, the same thing. It's yours or it's not.
True.
And this technology... Even the most junior infantryman knows bats and hides and the devices to enroll someone into the system, which more or less creates the database, And then a match can be had one of two ways. Number one, when a bomb is about to go off and we defuse it before it does, we still dust it for prints and skin. And then run that into the database. And if there's a match, you've identified who made the bomb and you've identified a potential terrorist and someone that could be affirmatively targeted by a tactical operations center. The other way is the bomb goes off. We still do a forensic tactical site exploitation, dust the bits and pieces and the wires and the boards that are left there. And if we still record that information, if the person isn't in the system yet, but their fingerprints and DNA are, when American personnel meet them in the field or they're trying to access an American post or what have you, there's the match that way. And you can detain the person immediately.
That's pretty fascinating.
So, for the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, our own court saying that the $1 billion of investment into this technology to fight these wars is an abyss, I think is less than ideal.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fishy that this was this last judgment from this judge, too. I mean, that just from my perspective sounds fishy. It sounds to me like they were saying, hey, just rubber stamp this on your way out the door and sweep it under the rug. But
it's hard to ignore that.
And to your point, I mean, it would make sense that you would get a judge that has combat experience or at least has been in these militarized areas. I mean, that doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense either. But
I'm still here, John. There?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I lost it for a moment.
Sorry about that. I think you said it sounds fishy, and I think it does, too. Ordinarily, I'm not a conspiracist or a conspiracy theory. I was a former prosecutor on active duty and defense counsel and
of course.
23 years to all combined experience now, and that's the Army I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, when you look at the opinion the Army Court drafted, and you look at that they called an abyss, they included language in there that suggests Lawrence changed the rules of engagement. They do not say that he was acquitted of it, even though he was. And then you marry that up with the chief judge of the very same court saying the incorrect things. And both the chief judge and the judge who wrote the opinion are appointed by Lieutenant General Charles Petty, the judge advocate general of the Army. And he's saying the same thing. So all three are saying the very same thing. And that kind of lays out the breadcrumbs and connects the dots that this is a shocking miscarriage of justice. And again, to those folks who would be interested, it would be important to read Mr. Brown's book.
It certainly is. I spoke with another guest and asked him the same thing. I was talking to Scott Bennett weeks ago, and I was just to the point going, how can these superior officers knowingly go through with this mess? Because, I mean, like you said earlier,
there's
an
answer.
Excuse me?
I think there's an answer to that.
Okay.
I really do. And this is based upon largely learning this case and then observing the things that have unfolded and tracking and securing the evidence we found. They forget that their job is to protect the integrity of the military justice system and the process itself. And instead, they're former prosecutors at heart, and they want to take an advocate's position and protect the Army rather than protect the integrity of the military justice system. In other words, they're not concerned about the objectivity and fairness of the court as much as they are about protecting their client, who's the Army.
Hmm.
That would be my answer. That's
yeah.
Maher on it. But
it just seems so sad. I mean, from an outsider, I mean, I know a whole lot of military and a lot of military in the family, and as an outsider, you always sort of look at it as it's a brotherhood, much like the fire department, the police department, you know, and you have each other's
yes,
back.
It is.
And then when you see the COs on the base and everybody else just seemingly scapegoating your client here, it just seems insane. I mean, I don't know how you can do that and sleep at night, but that's just me.
Lawrence was taken, his rifle and his pistol were taken away, and he could not go into the dining facility on Kandahar Airfield. Because if you weren't armed, you weren't allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to eat Funyuns and Doritos and Ding Dongs and Zingers out of the Class 6.
Jeez.
And pay for it out of pocket. Then when the unit was online to fly home out of Kandahar Airfield back to Fort Bragg, the battalion commander said to him, "You're not, find your own way. You're not on my stick. You're not going on my flight." That's how ostracized he was. And to some extent, probably an equal extent, those first 9 soldiers who got immunity. They, too, went through that crucible. Now, thankfully, they didn't get to go to jail or go to prison and have the stigma of double murder and attempted murder following them. But at the same time, they too were mistreated by the Army. And that, to me, is the highest, shall I say, contortion or manipulation of otherwise very good people who went over to do their duty and had the courage to meet the enemy and shoot the enemy into the ground.
Yeah. It's such a disservice to the American people as well, because they get a lot of the, in my humble opinion, just propaganda. You know, you see the baseball game and the flag and the support the troops and support the troops. And I'm going, well, something's awry here, because this gentleman definitely did not deserve any of this treatment, and certainly not from the brass in the Army all the way to the, like you were saying, just getting a flight home. I mean, what the heck is going on?
Mm-hmm. Tough. And here's the thing, too, though. An important piece we haven't discussed,
sure,
is Clint Lawrence himself.
Please.
And Clint Lawrence himself, he is an outlier or a statistical anomaly. He is, in my estimation, I'm not just saying that because I'm his attorney.
Sure.
I'm saying that because I'm, you know, almost 50 years old and have lived a little bit of life. And he has said things along the lines of, John, if I didn't give that order, and my paratroopers got killed or injured, I'd be in a different kind of prison for the rest of my life. Now, I think that just gives you a glimpse or some insight into the character of the man that Alan Tracy Lawrence and Gene Lawrence and the entire Lawrence family raised. That's who he is. And he's a motivator wherever he is. When other newer soldiers are, you know, assigned to the disciplinary barracks for their crimes, he doesn't let them lay around and mope around. He says, you got to get up. You got to get enrolled in college. You got to take advantage of what you can do before your benefits run out. You've got to conduct PT. You've got to take care of yourself. You've got to get on a reading program and a vocational program and a spiritual development program and a physical training program. And he sets that example, and it can be contagious. Yeah. So that's just a couple of the things that I could offer as to who he is now. And some people, I think, after 6 years of unjust incarceration and being labeled double murderer and attempted murderer, would be bitter about it. In all the times I've seen him over these years, not once has he not been a gentleman, affable, up to date on the current news and politics and developments, well-read, empathetic, self-effacing, witty, fully prepared as an active participant in his own defense, and an inspiration. He really brings life to the old saying, you grow where you're planted. And you know, he's made some quips every now and then. He goes, well, at least nobody's shooting in here.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, for my opinion, he seems to have a whole lot more character than the people that have allowed this to go on and this whole miscarriage of justice to occur. It's just ridiculous.
You know, John, through this whole thing, 6 years, 7 years, the year before he was court-martialed, John is my witness. Well, I know he hasn't heard it, and I can say as Clint's mother, I have never one time heard Clint speak ill against the soldiers that spoke against him and received immunity. I've never heard, he loves his country to this day. He respects his country, and he's never talked ill against it. He's positive. Now, every once in a while, as his mother, he has to put me in check because, you know, I'm really frustrated what they're doing. But Clint will straighten me out and say, Mama, here's the thing. We have to stay positive. I did what I had to do, and I would do it again. But we have to stay positive. We're not going to their level, you know. And he's just he'll explain to me with the guys, every time you talk about those soldiers that were there with him, you know, it frustrated me that they turned against Clint. But Clint says, Mom, you've got to realize these soldiers had been to hell and back for months on that same battlefield. They were protecting themselves. They had families. Many of them had families. I was a new lieutenant. They only had just known for 3 days. And he said, so you can't feel ill at them, you know, and that's truly how he feels. That's just who he is.
And when the jury verdict came in to 20 years in prison, which ultimately became 19, mm-hmm. Clint Lawrence said, I take full responsibility for my men. That's what he said, yeah. One of the last things before he walked out of the court martial.
Yeah, and he told me, he said, Mama, if anybody has to go to prison over this, it'll be me. I'm the lieutenant on the ground, and I told them, I gave them the okay to engage. And he said, and I'd do it again, because I brought all of my men home.
That's true courage. I like it.
And
go ahead.
And speaking of true courage, one of the things we quoted to the Army Court, which they never even talked about, was the International Law of Armed Conflict. It used to be called the Law of War.
Okay.
And that is when you're engaged in combat and civilians or you know, protected property gets killed or injured or wounded or destroyed, that's not murder. It's called collateral damage. And there was no analysis whatsoever of that applicable law to the Lawrence case, either before he was sent to trial or after on appeal. But all of this is set forth in our papers, which are available to your viewership or listenership.
Sure.
On freeclintlawrence.com, at uap.org, at maherlegalservices.com, or at lawyersdefendingwarriors.com. And all, most of the legal papers that have been filed in the Lawrence case are available for public use and public reader consumption, if you will.
Okay. And we'll definitely have links to all that on the webpage as well. One more thing, how can everybody help Mr. Lawrence, his family? I mean, I didn't want to get into finances, but I'm assuming if you're court-martialed, you're no longer getting a check, and I'm assuming it's a dishonorable discharge, so that might carry a stigma, even if you weren't in prison. So I'm thinking you're looking at
right.
No check, no benefits, and a stigma that's going to carry you for quite a bit if anybody doesn't know the true story here. So.
Well, the UAP out of North Carolina, where they at now, John? Virginia?
Alexandria, UAP, Virginia.
Yes. The UAP is supporting Clint and the family as far as our trips back and forth to see Clint. And they're supporting the legal matters of several different soldiers and Marines that this has happened to, but you can go on their website and donate to them because they're our support, and that's where we would prefer. Now, if somebody would want to donate directly to Clint, you can write him a letter, but you can only send him a money order. But UAP supports Clint, so Clint's preference is to you to donate to UAP if you could.
Okay, well, that sounds great.
And another thing
go for it, John.
You can do is pick up the book, Amazon.com, Travesty of Justice. And it's only $2.99. And the reason at that price point was the idea to get it in as many people's hands so a stiff price wouldn't be an obstacle to picking up the book. You can get it in the e-version or you could order it in paperback. And like Anna said, you know, I've been living the case, but she's been living it every much in a far different way, given that it's her son, but it's an eye-opener even for Anna, which is, I think, very good because it lays out the case, it treats 1st Platoon with respect, it treats every one of the casualties with respect, and it lays out the defense issues in a compelling way. So it tells a story of combat, it tells a story of Afghanistan, it tells a story of Bales in Panjwani District, it tells a story of the pretrial, the trial, the appeal, the new evidence, and it brings us up to speed to where we are today. So it's really a comprehensive look at the whole history of the case, but it's written in a way where you don't have to work through legal mumbo jumbo or legal terminology or anything like that. It's written for the enjoyment of readers, and hopefully that will inspire people, like Anna said, make your blood boil.
Yes, every American needs to read it. But it's we have it on Amazon, and it's in the paperback book or the Kindle, either one. So
okay.
It's available.
And once again, that's Travesty of Justice by Don Brown. And they can check out your website, Anna, as, what's that one more time?
FreeClintLawrence.com.
All right. That sounds good. Any closing things or things that we haven't talked about you want to get into before we close up?
We also have a Facebook page of Free Clint Lawrence where it's updated and we can the viewers can ask questions, and you can follow us on Facebook as well.
All right. And I please encourage everyone to do that. This is a story that really does need a whole lot more press than it's gotten. I sort of happened upon it online myself, but purely by accident. And I was, the more I delved into it and got into it, I was more disgusted all the time. So please, everyone, check out the book and avail yourselves of the story. It's definitely worth trying to help this gentleman out. Once again,
thank
please,
you, John.
Thank you so much for being on the program, Mrs. Lawrence and John as well. If I can be of any assistance to you in the future, I will happily do so.
Thank you, John.
Much obliged, sir. Thank you.
You bet. All right. Have a good one. Thank you. I want to thank you all for joining us again on the Anomic Age today. Special thanks to our guests, Anna Lawrence and John Mayer, for being on the program today. Had a lot of information today, and it really only scratched the surface, so make sure and check out Guest Media. We'll have a whole lot of links to the book about Clint Lawrence, to all the guest media, to everything you could possibly think of regarding today's show. Very special show today. I really hope that that some of this information can get to the right people and really really bring this whole incident to light. So please check out Guest Media. As always, share anomicage.com. where you can find all this week's guest media and the others, all the shows, all the videos, all the contact information, all the social media links, as well as the app links. And most importantly, for me anyway, the donation button at the bottom right. So please, if you are so inclined, donate a little bit to Anomic Age, join the newsletter, and check out all of the previous shows. As I always say, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So please get out there and make a difference. Until next time, see you. Be safe out there.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age Project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more money.